Ms. Parkinson Rufo.
He had, like all the other Germans of military age, been in the Wehrmacht and had been wounded. He had a big scar on his face and his wounds. His wife had been at what she was a university graduate also, I think, in physics, I'm not sure. But she had had her right arm amputated at the shoulder, and she had had cancer. So she is now surviving with the left arm only. But what she could do with her one arm absolutely amazed her. She could knit Fair Isle in the means of a little sort of red shaped piece of wood with a hole in it, which she jammed between her knee and put the long end of the knitting needle in that while she knitted with her left hand. And this was typical of the undefeated atmosphere of that home. They accepted what had come to them, that they were not going to be beaten. They were going to make the best of what they had. They had three children, a boy of 7, a girl of 6, and a girl of 4. And they had a pleasant little flat. And when they invited me to spend Christmas with them, I thought the first thing I had to do was at least to provide them with some food, because they certainly couldn't feed an extra person out of their neighbor and surprise. So I rushed down to Matthew and bought up whatever I could in my soap, toothbrushes, comb, curly grips, and chocolate, and biscuits, and some tins of meat. And I delivered those goods to them in the week before Christmas, as tactfully as I could. They came to Christmas Eve. They told me that midnight mass in the local Catholic church would be celebrated as usual, but it wouldn't be at midnight, it would be at 5 o'clock in the morning. So I went with them to mass in the local church. And it was very fully attended. And I recognised in the choir one or two of the people I'd known from the health department in the town hall. We went home to their house, and they had to help Tatiana. They had a young girl as another step who did quite a lot of the domestic work. And we had breakfast, and then we adjourned to the living room, which was divided into two by a curtain. And I couldn't see what was in the far room, but the father of the family had got an enormous family Bible spread out on his desk, which he'd opened at the story of in St. Luke of the Nativity. And Ian Norbert, the 7-year-old, and he stood by his father and followed the reading as his father began to read extracts from the Bible. And every now and again they stopped and they sang a carol. And then Tatiana moved into the next room and pulled back the curtain, and there was a Christmas tree with candles on it. And she began to light the candles, and we sang a special carol which was talking about candles on the Christmas tree. But the rest of the room was crowded in suits. And after we had the carol, we had another meeting, and we slowly moved to the time. They uncovered the first bit, which was covered up in the sheet. And it was a little print set, which they obviously kept from year to year, which most family families had. Lovely little carved figures, there's Mary and the baby, the shepherds, the kings, the sheep, and the little stable scene. And the children were all chatting away, the other ones were telling the girls and so on. And then we sang another carol, and who were the members of the party, and then they uncovered another book. And this time, it was included in the first by the person of the story, which they made themselves. They tiled it with only the strips that had been given them. They'd made with the fifth century of the land with top off with some of the feet that come in the castle and do it. And they got to this, and I think we made them back the reason that they came back. But the children busy for another few minutes anyway. So then we had another colour, and then they uncovered again some of the things that were hidden. And the next bit they uncovered was a Danish kitchen. Now, in Germany, they're not so keen about those houses. They do like old rooms. And they look like a stone pot with just a back and two shaping sideboards, exactly as a stage designer would set up a stage set. And the founder of the family had spent hours making this old kitchen out of scrap materials. And it was beautiful. It had a tiny little bicycle mount double for it. It had a bucket made out of an old skin cotton, so that plastic carton for the rose farm. Another half of that had been made into a buffet pot, and a broom had been made out of an old teapot. And in general, it was a miracle of making a man. It was absolutely fantastic. And of course, the small four-year-old was absolutely remarkable for that. Then they uncovered some, and this time it was little girls' dolls. Somewhere in November, their own favourite dolls had disappeared on account of it. And they were going around saying, "Mucky, I can't find the dolly, what's happened to her?" And Mother would say comforting, "Look, I expect she'll turn up, didn't worry." And anyway, the dolls had disappeared. When they reappeared, they had new hair made somehow. They had new clothes made out of some of the scrap materials that had been available. And it was their old dolls and their new dolls. And the little girls were thrilled. New dolls wouldn't have given them any more pleasure at all than to find their old dolls dressed again and back. And then we got so far, and eventually we had our McDonald's. And this consisted of the outfit, which was a cork setting. A special consignment had been obtained by local British practices. People didn't have a loose or a safety line for that, but they had managed to get to come out to this cottage, and that was our Christmas dinner. And this was followed by special Christmas biscuits, which they used to call the glass of cakes and certain special cakes. It tasted pretty awful at the end of the day, but they looked right. They didn't have nearly enough fat in them to make them really palatable. But when I was satisfied, they had managed to produce the glasses for Christmas. And they felt they'd achieved something. And I thought, well, I think these people have an incredible amount of courage to face what was ahead. Now, those three children were comparatively lucky. They had a home, they had good parents, they were devout Catholics, they had a lot of support in their community. But all those three children were, in fact, Tibetan tested and proved positive, and they were in the feeding scheme as well. The youngest of them in fact, had an enlarged heart. I kept in touch with that family after I returned to Britain in 1948. And in years that followed, that little girl, a kind of other 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and when they reached their teens, they came over and stayed with my father's family and met them soon. And that little 4-year-old had a very badly enlarged heart. I don't know to what extent this was due to any deprivation during the war or what, but she had had to have a very big heart operation. When she came over as a teenager, she told us that what her father had had to pay for that heart operation would have bought them a small aeroplane. They were a wonderful family. I don't know what else I can tell you about them, or about some of the other people I met. One of the very useful things that the relief teams were able to do was to set up conferences and discussion groups for the social workers. And we had a lot of day conferences and a couple of weekend conferences where we were able to take with us social workers from the health office of the town and county organisations and representatives from Caritas and MSL and so on. And it was a new experience for the denominational social workers, because many of them had never even met their opposite numbers in their own town or their own county until we had managed to get them together at these conferences. And it did help to get over an awful lot of prejudice. One of the other things that I used to have was 2 days a week I was given a room in the town hall to act as a sort of surgery, as you might say, what the local councillors do these days in England, when people could come with their problems and see if there was anything I could do to help them. And these were very traumatic occasions, because so often there is nothing I could do to help them. But in some cases, I was able to help. Sometimes it was a question of acting as an intermediary with me with the government to secure some concession, which seemed reasonable in the circumstances. Since I was getting somebody temporarily, I think, out of camp, prison of travel, to attend a funeral or something of that kind. One of the things I was also getting was a lot of appeals from girls who had illegitimate children by British soldiers who were wanting to contact with the fathers. It was very much a part of the name of the house of grief. I remember a tragic case, really, of a woman who came to me who heard about the new miracle drug that the British had called penicillin. And her son was desperately ill, and she said, "Can't you get me some penicillin for my son?" And of course, I couldn't. There were only minimal quantities of it coming over. And this poor woman couldn't see, and I couldn't suddenly just ask for penicillin. And how to try and drink it. One of the supplies I did manage to get, although a very small quantity, but nevertheless was very helpful, on an appeal from the Madagascar Health Town, he said, our children are suffering desperately from worms. Is it possible you could get hold of a specific worms when you go back and leave England? And there was a guy called Smetterman, which apparently was the specific for treating intestinal worms. And when I came home on leave, I was able to buy a consignment of about half a pound of this particular drug and take it back to the medical officer. And he distributed it and had it made up in appropriate medicaments to treat these children. One of my photographs is one of the few children at the clinic waiting to get their supply of known tablets and known medicine. Anyway, and subsequently got another consignment of this stuff over to the medical offices for the appropriate use. Years later, 5 years later, I went back to Epping Garden and we had a sort of reunion. They put a notice in the local paper saying, Miss Parkinson, who used to be in the British Red Cross in Epping Garden, was coming over to visit and we'll be having a coffee party. So anybody that would like to regain contact is welcome to come. And we had this coffee morning and a lot of people turned up. And there was one particular woman who came and warmed her hand and greeted me and so on. And I was terribly puzzled. I couldn't really remember who she was or what a contact to be. And then she invited her and I said, could you help me? I've got a bad memory. In what way was she able to help you? And she said, you listen.
So that would have been in 53, 5 years after you had left Germany? I think you told me later that you tried to transfer from the Red Cross to UNRWA?
No, I tried between leaving the Friends Relief Service. I'd applied to join UNRWA then, but at that time they wound up UNRWA anyway, so it never happened. And I didn't believe that I didn't actually.
Why?
Oh, because we heard such awful stories about corruption in UNRWA.
With the black market, you mean?
Mm.
Why was it that you left in 1948 and not in another year?
I think they were winding up. I wanted to stay on because I still felt there was such a lot of work to do, so I'd stayed on longer than many people. And in 1948 they began to close down the relief workers, the relief teams, and our team in Reckling Housing was closed down, and the people who stayed on were dispersed to other teams and other work, but it was real retrenched all the time. And I felt I didn't want to make yet another move. I was moved to Dortmund for 2 or 3 months, but I thought, no, I had enough, I wanted to get back. And I felt there was a lot to be done in Britain. But funnily enough, I mean, we'd been so out of touch, being so overwhelmed with what we had to do there. But, we weren't really up to date with what was happening in Britain. I remember very well the election of 1945, because we had postal votes, of course, and my memories of it were rather funny, because we were in touch at that time with the military government. And after the announcement of the result of the election of the Labour victory, I went into the military government offices, copper group, of course, as all of us were, and saw a young officer we knew sitting with his head in his hands like this. And I said, "Oh dear, what's the matter?" He said, "The election." And I said, "Oh well, of course then you didn't vote Labour." "I did," he said, "that's the trouble." And obviously, he was like a good many others. He thought, "Oh well, I'll be a devil, I'll vote Labour, never had in my life that I'll vote Labour this time." And he was quite shattered, because he certainly hadn't intended a Labour government to get back into power.
How had things changed? What did you mean about the changes in Britain in 48?
Well, the very day I arrived in Britain was July the 5th, 1948. And that was the very day that all the new legislation came into force that the Labour government had passed. The New Children Act, the New National Assistance Act, and the National Health Service. The Education Act had already come in, but those major bits of legislation all came into force on July 5th, 1948. And there was a whole new feeling in the world of the brave new Britain that was being built. I hadn't got a job at that time, and for a little while I had to fill in with temporary jobs and did a bit of market research, as a matter of fact, in the north of England with a team of young students. We were trying to do market research on behalf of a dairy company who wanted to know where it was appropriate to open milk bars. And in the course of travelling around, I saw an advertisement for a meeting being addressed by a member of the Home Office Children's Department, the new set-up of the Children's Department. And I went to this meeting, I think it was in Harvard, and heard this woman speaking about the New Children Act and what it was going to produce. And I got fired with enthusiasm. My father, having worked in the National Children's Home, we were very much in child welfare and family, and thought, that's where I would like to work. And so I came back and decided that I would try and get into this uniform children's department. But there was an enormous rush of enthusiasm for it, and there were only two training courses going. The children's departments had been set up as a result of the legislation which was based on the Curtis Report, which was very famous at the time. The Curtis Report had followed on a report chaired by Lady Anne McCurdy on the death of a small boy, Dennis O'Neill, who died as a result of ill treatment in a foster home. And a royal commission had been set up to investigate that. And as a result of that Royal Commission, they set up the Curtis Commission to investigate what is being done for children in this country who can no longer live with their own parents. And this Curtis Commission had been working for 18 months, very hard, visiting children's homes, foster homes, residential nurses and so on. And they'd uncovered what a tangle childcare was in. And their recommendations were very firmly, there should be one authority only for all work for children who can't live with their own families. And there should be training for all the people who are working with such children, because it's very skilled work. There should be training for the field workers and training for the residential workers. And this was embodied in the Children Act of 1948. And training courses were set up, but nearly enough, of course, for a long time. But in fact, having had some degree of social work training to do it, and counting on that, counting on those that have involved training in a certain area of social work, I became an untrained child care officer and was appointed in Kent and worked for them for many years. And I remained in social work until I retired.